you have to be careful how you define anti-intellectual. I'm thinking of the case of William Miller, for example, who was a farmer in upstate New York and who in the 1830s was converted and did intensive study of the Bible. So that's not anti-intellectual. But his confidence that he, pretty much on his own, could figure out particularly the prophetic parts of the Bible, that would have been an anti-intellectual move.
Welcome to It Means What It Means, the podcast in which a guy with some college and a day job has long-form conversations about biblical text. A quick word on housekeeping. It was brought to my attention recently that I don't do a great job of giving contact information so that people can reach out to me. I think that's probably a function of me just not believing that anyone would be interested in reaching out to me. So I will make sure that I do a better job of that. And in the future, I'll make sure that's at the top of every episode. For this episode, feel free to email me at itmeanswhatitmeans, all one word, at gmail.com with feedback, guest suggestions, or inquiries. Going forward, I'll make sure that there's a standard introduction at the top of most episodes. Some of them will have their own unique, but most of them will just be a standard canned pre-made introduction. Please let me know if there's anything else that I can do to improve the podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, use the link that's in the show notes to go to the Patreon that I've set up for the podcast. Anyway, that's enough of that. It's enough housekeeping. On to the real show. So when I was a junior in high school, I had to write a paper on Jonathan Edwards for my English class. I came across a section about Edwards in a book titled A History of Christianity in the United States and Canada. I enjoyed the book so much, I went to the librarian and asked, "What if I didn't return this book? How much would that cost me?" She could tell I wanted to just get a book that was probably going to cost me more if I tried to buy it on my own. So I ended up turning it in. I didn't steal that book from the library. But something about that book made me, rather than just reading that section on Edwards, I flipped all the way to the front and I read the entire book. And I learned about how populist politicians like Andrew Jackson served simultaneously as indicators and leaders of a movement away from intellectual forms of public life or religion. The book helped me to see my country had somehow changed and remained the same over time. It was a very interesting perspective that I think I've been building on over the years. After high school, I picked up a copy by that same author, Mark Knoll, called Turning Points, Decisive Moments in the History of Christianity. From that book, I learned that, among other things, the schism that happened between Eastern and Western, that is, Orthodox and what would come to be Catholic Christianity, was not, as my teachers had told me, simply about icons. But rather, it was a debate that had been going on all the way back to the Council of Nicaea, or at least the days following the Council of Nicaea. I also found a depiction of Martin Luther that was less heroic and unattainable and more bore a stunning resemblance to the combative and arrogant crusader of the French Quarter, Ignatius J. Riley, from the novel A Confederacy of Dunces. Somehow it humanized and made Luther more off-putting to me. Knoll's work would also illuminate things much closer to home for me. After reading Turning Points, I would pick up his book Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And in that book, I got a bird's eye view of something that I had only experienced on the ground. Discovering his insights, along with the late Kurt Vonnegut, roughly in that same time, showed me that I could and should learn more. That the only thing keeping me from learning was the courage to look around and ask questions. If you go to Mark Knoll's author page on Amazon, you'll see 58 titles listed. Some of those are duplicates, but if you look a little bit closer, it's because it's the difference between a third and a fourth edition of something. This is proof that Knoll's is a relentless intellect. In addition to the titles that I've already listed, you'll find on his Amazon page, The Civil War is a Theological Crisis. America's God, Protestantism, a very short introduction. The New Shape of World Christianity, How American Experience Reflects Global Faith. The Old Religion in a New World, The History of North American Christianity. Today, though, we will be discussing his 2022 book, America's Book, The Rise and Decline of a Bible Civilization, 1794 to 1911. This is an 864-page book about how Americans engage with biblical text. It is tailor-made for this podcast. Not that I wouldn't have found an opportunity and done a lot of work to get him on the podcast to talk about any of his books. At any rate, I think that's enough of me talking. Here's my conversation with Mark A. Knoll. Mark A. Knoll, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Before we get going, will you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am a retired historian who enjoys reading and going to the library probably more than almost anything else. I live in Wheaton, Illinois with my wife, Maggie, of well over 50 years. I taught at Wheaton College for almost 30 years and then 10 years at the University of Notre Dame before I retired, moved back to the Wheaton area because we have family in the Chicagoland. I've been interested in the history of Christianity since probably collegiate days, and as an academic matter, because I'm interested also in American history and British history and Canadian history, but also as a personal matter, because it has seemed to me that, at least in, as I approach things, historical accounts of the faith have been very meaningful.
So what we're going to be discussing today is your book, America's Book, The Rise and Decline of a Bible Civilization, 1794 to 1911. What motivated you to write this book? Was it intended to follow the book that precedes it in time frame?
Yes. Now, let's see, almost more than 40 years ago, with some other historian friends, we concluded that Christian discussion of the character of the Bible, the nature of Scripture, was a really important matter, but that as historians, we were quite interested in how the Bible had been put to use. And so I have actually been working on this broader subject on and off with many interruptions for over four decades. Earlier, I was able to publish a book on the use of the Bible in the colonial American period that brought the story up to the 1780s. And this is a continuation, drawing on quite a bit of recent research, but also interest and reading and research that goes back into the late 1970s and 1980s. The purpose has always been twofold: to see more clearly how the American environment has influenced the use of the Bible, and then also to see more clearly how the presence of the scriptures has played a role in broader American society.
And so it's a very long book, right?
Yes. Originally, there was going to be one book that took from Columbus to then the Obama era. But I was already at about 300 pages when I was only up to the American Revolution. A good decision seemed to be to do that book on the colonial period. And that period really is quite different in many ways from what follows, even though they're obviously connected. And then to work from the late 1790s, for a reason I could explain later maybe, up until the early 20th century, because after the early 20th century, while the Bible no doubt remains quite present in American society, it simply is not at the central point that it was for so many years. The pluralization of religion in the United States, the general secularization of society, all of these things displaced the Bible from the central position that it occupied for so long. So stopping the writing about this matter in the early 20th century made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I can see that. I think, so a book that is completely unrelated in the real world to your writing, to your history, but is indelibly linked with it in my brain is Neil Gaiman's fantasy novel, American Gods. And in there, there's this kind of weird thesis that somehow when people bring their gods to America, they're just not the same, that America is not a hospitable environment in the way that the homeland was. And I've thought about that in terms of a thesis that I've picked up from you elsewhere about America as having a unique entrepreneurial and freeform kind of religion. Does that apply to the Bible too, as opposed to the old country or the old world?
It certainly does. Production of the Bible in the colonial period was almost non-existent in the American colonies because in Britain, the official king's printers had a monopoly on Bible production. So there were plenty of Bibles in the colonies and there was plenty of reading of the Bible. But the colonies were still part of the British Protestant regime. The scriptures are very important. The scriptures are, in fact, central to the British self-conception as a free Protestant people. But with the American Revolution, that British colonial framework falls away. And there's a great deal of discussion, a great deal of internal debate. How is the Christian faith going to survive once you get rid of the way things have been done in Europe? Usually the term is Christendom, where there's a very tight relationship between the churches and the state, between the educational institutions and the institutions of the church, and where government officials just take it for granted that they're to provide some kind of guidance for the churches, and the churches take it for granted that they're having some kind of central place in the governing structures. After the American Revolution, that's no longer the case. The revolution takes place in part, at least, because a majority, probably, of American colonists believe that the established Church of England, the Anglican Church, had contributed to the corruption that they saw in Parliament that led then to the what they call the tyranny of the colonies. After the American Revolution, while government still supports the churches in some of the new American states, the national government deliberately says we're not going to have that kind of arrangement. So the question is, how is Christian faith going to survive? And it survives by individuals taking responsibility themselves for doing what in the past had been undertaken with government support. And that obtained for the history of the Bible as much as anything else. So how do we have Bibles in the new United States? There's still some importing from Britain and also from German-speaking areas, because there's a lot of German-speaking Protestants in the U.S. But the production of Bibles takes place because entrepreneurs simply strike out on their own to produce Bibles. The leading Bible publisher, printer in the early United States is a man named Matthew Carey, a recent immigrant from Ireland, who in the early 1790s determines to publish on his own a Catholic version, a Douay Rheims translation of the Bible. How does he do it? He just advertises, solicits people willing to pay him in advance, and does the Bible. He doesn't wait for government permission. He doesn't wait for applying for legislation. He just goes about and does it. And that's what eventually happens at a huge scale. Bible production in the United States is a little bit slow in getting off the ground, but by 1800, there are dozens of printers in a number of cities that are producing the Bible. Philadelphia and Boston are the two largest ones, New York also. But then there are people printing the Bible in obscure places, upstate New York, upstate New England, rural Pennsylvania, rural Virginia, not too much in the South yet, but in these places. And these Bibles are all being produced by people who simply think it's important to have the scriptures available. There's just a lot of really interesting people who, over the course of American history, conclude we need a Bible. And sometimes it means that the person will do their own printing of the King James Version. Sometimes it means they'll do their own translations. I've got a fair number of pages in my book of a wonderful woman by the name of Julia Smith, who taught herself Greek and Hebrew, did several translations of the Bible, and then eventually in 1876, the year of the American centennial, published her own translation of the Bible from Greek and Hebrew. It was a Bible celebrated by some of the women's groups who thought that the women had been neglected too long in the use of scriptures, and it didn't really catch on with the public at large, but it was another of the many instances where someone had concluded themselves, without bothering to ask anybody's permission, Do we need the scriptures? Can I provide the scriptures? How can I go about doing it? And then they just did it. So yes, the United States religious life has been characterized by a lot of self-starting entrepreneurial individuals. And that's no less true for the history of the Bible as for many other spheres of American life.
Obviously, the move away from Christendom didn't start in the New World. It started across the Atlantic. However, we did a really good job of solidifying it. And so the example, I remember hearing about her, like listening to this book in preparation. I was listening to the audiobook, hearing about her, and the question came up in my brain, why didn't learning Greek and Hebrew become more popular in America? It seems like if it was going to be anywhere, it would be here. Is there anything that you could see as far as the record that points to an explanation as to why that didn't happen? Is it just like the obvious, it's too difficult?
Oh, that's actually a really interesting question for any number of reasons. And Julia Smith is a good example of someone who was serious about the Bible, but also thought that the scriptures had been abused, in her case, in a very local case, by the local town officials in New England, taking her property away once her father had died, and it was her and her sister who had the ownership of the property. So she was motivated because she thought the Bible was important. She loved the scriptures, but she also thought that the use of the King James Version had been an abuse. So she took it upon herself to learn Greek, learn Hebrew, and as I said, do multiple translations of the Bible. There's another really interesting incident of the same sort. The Bible was used as a daily book for reading in American, what we'd call today public schools, tax-supported schools, right from their beginning, the 1820s and 1830s. The reasoning was that a republic that does not have monarchs and aristocracy needs the individuals in the republic to have moral balance, moral character themselves. What better way to have moral balance or moral character than reading the Bible? That may not have been the best kind of theological reasoning, but it certainly was prevalent in the new United States. Schools established by tax money from the 1830s and 1820s and 1830s regularly had required daily Bible readings. By the 1860s in Cincinnati, there was a problem, not because a large number of the population was nervous about the Bible, but because growing numbers of the population were nervous about the King James Bible as the Protestants' Bible. Cincinnati happened to be a place of increased German Catholic migration, and actually one of the places in the United States where Jewish population was beginning to grow by the 1860s. So there were petitions to the Cincinnati School Board to say, nothing against the Bible at all, but because we have so many different communities now in Cincinnati, we should not have the schools mandating that everybody reads from the King James Bible every day. So the school board made that decision. The decision was challenged by those who thought that it was imperative to keep reading the King James Bible in schools, and there was a legal case. The interesting thing about the original languages was that a Jewish rabbi, Isaac Wise, who was in the process of becoming well-known in American Judaism, but also fairly well-known more generally, he had a couple of interviews with President Lincoln during the Civil War. Rabbi Wise said, of course we must honor the scriptures, but why are we honoring a translation? If we want to read the Bible in our tax-supported schools, why not let the Jewish students read it from the Hebrew? And Christians, if you want to read the Bible, let's use the Greek New Testament to read the Bible. Now, he was speaking half tongue-in-cheek, but only half. And, of course, people just, if they paid any attention at all to him, they just laughed. But his notion that you really were not getting at the Bible if you're using only a translation and using only one translation, that notion certainly had purchase in the United States, but was never a particularly strong sentiment. Now, why? I think the reason was that in the American decision that there would not be a state church universities and colleges would not be run in the same way by the state church that had been the case in Europe. There would be a lot of religious sponsorship for colleges and universities, but not as an official arm of the state. That education had to come from the bottom up. Whereas in Europe, education had been controlled by elites. And in the case of Britain, it was just common. You had to know Greek, and you very often had to learn Hebrew if you wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And the same would be true in the continent. The universities were controlled by learned people who had time and energy and ability to learn the languages. And they were the ones who spent the greatest amount of time with the original languages of Scripture. Whereas in the United States, the imperative was to get ordinary people to read the Bible and use the Bible and trust in the Bible. The groups that became really important in the early years of the Republic, early 19th century, were the Methodists and the Baptists, who did marvels of work in promoting the Scriptures amongst the populace. But they were busy people. They did not look particularly kindly on higher learning. And they were the great promoters of the reading and believing and use of the Bible in English, and particularly the Bible as King James, in the King James Version. Yes, there's every reason to think of the status of learning Greek and Hebrew in the United States as a function of more general cultural and educational currents, developments.
So that kind of takes us back to the entrepreneurial nature of American religion, because it's those very successful denominations, like you said, Baptist and Methodist particularly, who are really good at evangelizing. And the metrics of success there are how many people are being baptized, how many people are coming to faith when you go and you preach or you have a revival or whatever the case may be. And it's flattening out the society. So there isn't like a ruling class necessarily dictating overall national identities and priorities. Does that kind of sum up what you're saying?
Very much. And flattening out is a really good metaphor for what happened. And from an evaluative point of view, even from a Christian evaluative point of view, I think you'd have to say there were some very positive advantages and some very positive disadvantages, very negative disadvantages. My friend Nathan Hatch published a book some time ago called The Democratization of American Christianity, in which he pointed out how many good things and then how many problems came when the churches were cut loose from elite authority and were allowed to develop on their own. The good things were massive popular Christianization. The bad things included a ready fire aim mentality, a public space in which the most persuasive users of the Bible were not necessarily those who reasoned the best or who had the best grasp of the Scriptures, but who were rhetorically most persuasive, who could move a crowd with their rhetoric. So the American situation is different than Europe. In some ways, from a Christian standpoint, it's better. In some ways, from a Christian standpoint, it's worse.
I think, and you didn't use this word, so I'm not putting this word in your mouth, but anti-intellectualism is a thing that does show up in American Christianity, particularly in the denominations, or because they're not necessarily thought of as being Orthodox Christianity, some of the sects that developed out of American Christianity, they do have a vein of anti-intellectualism in them. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think so. But you have to be careful how you define anti-intellectual. I'm thinking of the case of William Miller, for example, who was a farmer in upstate New York and who in the 1830s was converted and did intensive study of the Bible. So that's not anti-intellectual, but his confidence that he, pretty much on his own, could figure out particularly the prophetic parts of the Bible, that would have been an anti-intellectual move. Usually, and this would be the case in the U.S. and in Europe, intellectual life included as a premise that people would try out their ideas with a broad set of others who had special training, and a process of dialogue and mutual critique would lead to clear understanding of whatever the problem at issue is. Someone like William Miller was certainly intellectual and a very, very diligent study of the Bible, reading again the King James Bible, many times and then working hard at synthesizing what he read. But his conclusions, having to do with specifying the return of Christ in a day in 1843, and when that didn't happen, a day in 1844, was his own conclusion that then a publicist by the name of Hines persuaded many people to accept. And in that sense, trusting in his own expertise without much specialized training, without any specialized training to come up with the key to the message of the Bible, I think would qualify as anti-intellectual.
Fortunately for the listeners, I can think of a guy who did a pretty good job about 30 years ago writing a book about the intellectual state of at least one form of American Christianity. And I know you're not here to talk about that book, but Scandal of the Evangelical Mind is a really good book. Even still, I just recently went back through that one. But it does seem if you can win a bunch of people over, that's considered success. Even if, and the Millerite, like that's a pretty good example. I think there are some advocates of some of the holiness traditions. Even I think 20 years ago, a guy wrote a book called The Second Christendom saying that charismatic ideology, in part because of its anti-intellectual background, was going to form the next Christendom. I don't know that he's right, but that's I'm putting that together with some of the depictions that I'm seeing in your book. And maybe that's not something you intended to come across, but.
No, I think I was, again, struck by, I suppose a cliche is two sides of the same coin. In the United States, religion is very free. And that means that there's an access to the Christian faith. There's an ability to read the Bible for people for themselves. There's great encouragement to read the Bible for yourself. Think of the Gideons in the 20th century have distributed hundreds of millions of Bibles with the intent to have, not to tell people how they should read it necessarily, but just to read it. And this is, I think, had some very positive effects. What has not been positive is consensus based upon careful proposal and critique, argument back and forth, consideration of factors in the scriptures and factors outside of the scriptures that come to bear on the Bible. And again, in a culture that is open to many different voices, and where in a democratic society, the voices that are most effective in presenting themselves, regardless of the substance of their presentation, are the voices that will be persuasive. The American situation is not simple. If people are educated and say it's just been yahoos running around, that's much too strong of a denunciation. If people are not educated and say it's good that we've escaped the tyranny of the elites, that also is not good, because understanding the scriptures in any depth for at least matters beyond the basic story of sinful people needing reconciliation with God, understanding the scriptures in any depth does require a great deal of expertise in the languages, in understanding the cultures of the ancient Middle East and of the time of Christ and the Apostle Paul, understanding in a critical sense what people are taking for granted when they read the Bible, what they're not taking for granted. These are all aspects of intellectual life that require a lot of careful thought and a careful critique. And those elements, while they've been present in the United States, have not been dominant.
So in where my brain goes from there is thinking about the different perspectives and points of view and communities represented by their interpretation or approach to reading biblical texts. Is there one that you think has remained the most durable? And it can be for the period of the book or for the entirety of American history.
Yes, that is a good general question. I don't think there's a simple answer. And I'll try to explain why I don't think there's a simple answer by what in the study that went into the books on the history of the Bible what was involved. The first paper I did on this subject was in 1979. And it had to do with conceptions of the United States as a biblical nation between the American Revolution and the Civil War. And what was obvious in that research was that by the time we got to the Civil War and the nation's white population, there's a real strong disagreement on what the Bible teaches. There was not much disagreement on how to approach the Bible. I mean, that's a way of getting at your question. But I also discovered something then that over the years I've done quite a bit more reading on, and I think I understand it a little bit better. By the time we get to the American Civil War, it's not only white, largely Protestant with some Catholic, Bible believers in the country, but there is a surprising community of Bible-believing African-Americans. Now, why is that surprising? It's surprising because in the earlier history of the American colonies and the early history of the United States, when the question came up, is slavery as practiced in the United States, is that compatible with biblical Christianity? And although there were a significant number of white Protestants who said, no, it isn't, clearly, the majority of white Protestants, and they were the dominant religious group in the country, clearly the clear majority of white Protestants said either the Bible is just not clear about modern slavery, or yes, definitely the Bible just takes slavery for granted, so why shouldn't we? Okay, that would have been the main dominant way of approaching the Bible. But in the African-American community, it was not. And yet, by the time we get to the mid-19th century, there's a strong Christian, Bible-believing African-American communities, really, where trust in the scriptural message is just as strong, if not stronger, as in white communities, but where approaches to the Bible are very different. In the white community, and this, I think, will get at the question of what has been the dominant way of seeing the Bible in the U.S., the dominant way has had to do with ways of thinking that became prominent in Europe in the 17th century and the 18th century, and they continued on in a fashion in the United States. And that those ways of dealing with anything we can call influenced by the Enlightenment, or the idea that truth is something to be approached objectively. And very soon, 17th, 18th, on to the 19th century, there is a sense that the best model for approaching truth is what we today call a scientific model. That term, that word wasn't used that early on. But is you carefully gather up the facts, you put the facts together from as wide a range of places you can find them, and you make a hypothesis about what the facts show, and you run out the hypothesis, and you try to check it on other facts. And you have this way of approaching the Bible that has a lot to do with traditional ways of studying the scripture, although different in some ways as well. And that more or less Enlightenment view is sustained in many different ways. By the time we get to the late 19th century, in the mainstream population, there's the entrance of what we would call higher biblical criticism. And the tendency is to say the way we understand the past now scientifically is much more advanced. We see that human societies have changed over time. We have now the concept of evolution to explain how human societies develop. And so with that understanding of science, there is a loss of belief in the Bible as a supernatural gift from God. At the same time, however, we have other groups of believers who hang on to the Bible and say, no, we don't want to think of God as just made up, but we believe that God has always worked with people, and we too want to understand the Bible better. And how do we do that? We take the facts that are found in the verses, we put the facts from the different parts of the Bible together, and we can tell what the Bible has to say about the way we should live. That approach to using the Bible, sometimes called dispensationalism because of some prominent teachers of the 19th century, prominent focused on prophetic parts of the Bible. But the similarity in those two ways of dealing with the scriptures is to think that the Bible is a kind of code book that needs to be deciphered. At the same time, continuing on as a parallel strand are communities of Christians who they're not anti-intellectual, and they don't disagree with much that they hear from the white communities, the dominant and educated communities, but they are much more taken by the Bible as a narrative, as a story, as a history in which they have a part. So African-American communities, eventually Native American communities, where the Christianity took root, were deep into the Bible, but tended to see the Bible as a narrative in which they themselves were eventually included. Jesus said he came to bring the gospel to the poor, to the weak, to the blind, to the halt. And individuals who had been put upon by the larger society concluded, that's us. So when Jesus was talking about coming to free the captive, he meant it. And the freedom was certainly spiritual, but it was also more than spiritual. So we have this way of reading the Bible that's not opposed to the more, what we might call scientific ways of reading the Bible, but develops alongside it. And I think one of the Christian churches, particularly Protestant churches, and particularly evangelical and fundamentalist Protestant churches, survived and have survived in America, where the views of science often, or scientists often, disparage and don't take the Bible too seriously, is because they too have seen themselves as factored into the Bible story, the Bible narratives. And while it's important for them to keep studying the Bible systematically, it's also important for them to realize that they too are part of the biblical story of God reaching out to sinners in the work of Christ and the Holy Spirit. So that's a very long and involved answer to your question, but it has to do with the technical term hermeneutics. But while there's been a dominant forms of hermeneutics in the majority cultures of the United States, there have been some really significant variations in cultures that were on the margins.
When I was in high school, I read this book called Meaning of the Millennium, and it was the first of the like multi-point debate books that I knew of. I don't know if it was the first, but it's the first one that I know of. And it was on the different or four different points of view on Revelation 20 verses 1 through 6. And the amillennial, postmillennial, historic premillennial, and the dispensational premillennialist. And I believe it was the postmillennialist who started his initial essay out explaining that basically until about World War I, there was a positive attitude toward eschatology and a belief that, and it's a postmillennial idea, that things are just going to get better until Jesus returns. That's what's going to usher in his return. Does that square with what you've seen? And I know you don't really get past, you come right up to the cusp of World War I, but does that square with what you know of American history? Did it get more negative?
Yes, definitely. Serious Bible believers, and actually some that were liberal, some that were conservative, were after World War I much less optimistic about the gradual improvement of society toward the coming kingdom of Christ. I think what I would say about the situation with respect to end time, the 19th, 18th, and 19th century, was that Christian believers of all kinds almost universally believed in a second coming in which it would bring about the end of the age and the rule of Christ. But almost none of them, very few of them, and what the position you call historic premillennials would be one of them, very few of them thought that the thousand years mentioned in the book of Revelation was actually a prediction of things to come. And what was certainly the case in many Bible interpreters in the 18th and 19th century, and then I think probably in the book that you read by the amillennialists, would have been an argument such along these lines. But when the book of Revelation mentions 1,000 years, we should not start by just looking at other places in the Bible that mention 1,000 years, but we should try to ascertain to the extent possible what type of book, what type of literature is the book of Revelation. And in order to find an answer to that question, we need to look into the ancient world, to the Mediterranean world around the time of Christ, the first century on into the second century, and see if there are other books, other writings that look like the book of Revelation. And people who've done that have been satisfied to say, well, yes, there are other things like this. And it's quite clear that these other books are not oriented to necessarily telling the future, but are using imaginative, mythical language to talk about the present. And that certainly has been and continues to be one of the prominent ways of interpreting the book of Revelation among very serious Christian people. It's entirely true, but the truth that the book of Revelation mostly is presenting has to do with a very well-wrought, imaginative depiction of Christian faith in the first and second century, and then a deeply rooted theological statement about how Christianity is to exist in all centuries. Even though what are known as premillennial and dispensational views became very prominent in the United States in the late 19th and 20th century, they really are, at least to the best of my understanding, I would hesitate to present myself as an expert on Second Coming history, but these positions have really not been majority positions in the biblical interpretation at any time else.
I saw a book in November at SBL titled The End of Dispensationalism. And I know you're an historian, so you don't necessarily have to have an opinion on current events, but do you feel like that to me, as someone who grew up in evangelical dispensational world, that seemed like a bit of an exaggeration. That seems like a leap. What do you think about that?
Yes, I'm not sure if I'm thinking of the same book, but there's a really fine book by a man named Daniel Hummel called something like that, or maybe
The
Rise and Fall.
I think that may be the one. That's what it was.
The Rise and Decline, or Rise and Fall. I thought the argument was really very helpful because the research was broad. It included a lot of reading of serious academic titles, a lot of work by learned Bible people who had been associated with dispensational institutions who, in the 60s, 70s, 1980s, 90s, modified or altered their views so significantly that while they maybe still are called dispensational, look much more like traditional amillennial or historic premillennial views. So on that side of the picture, dispensationalism really is not much alive as a theological option for people who are who have devoted themselves to the serious languages, historical context, and so forth of the Bible. Yet, on the contrary, in American public life, all sorts of dispensational ideas are flourishing. I'm thinking of the late great Planet Earth in the 1960s.
Hal Lindsey.
And then the novels, the Left Behind series.
Yeah.
The Left Behind series, many books that received tremendous circulation. And then in some, even the political related situation, I think there are popular voices who look at events, say, in the Middle East or look at events in American politics and read them as fulfilling Bible prophecy. So in that sense, you have dispensational-like conclusions using the Bible to explain all sorts of current events. So I think that the really great contribution of Daniel Hummel's book was to show that when you talk about dispensationalism in the late 20th and 21st century, you're talking about two things. You're talking about the fate of a certain developed academic understanding of the Bible, and then you're talking about a lot of popular echoes and motifs and narratives that seem to be going from strength to strength, as opposed to what had been at one time a pretty serious intellectual defense of dispensational interpretations of the Bible. But again, I'm glad to defer to people like Hummel who really worked on this. And I'm just an interested spectator when anything happens after 1914.
In fairness to him, I'm that was more a gut feeling just based on my on-the-ground experience in the past and even now. I'm not questioning his scholarship or his actual thesis, but it does seem like the infrastructure for the kind of conspiracy thinking that likes a very specific kind of eschatology or end times prophecy, it's out there on the internet. They don't need seminaries or academic institutions as a backstop as much as they did 20 or 30 or 50 years ago. And I think my gut response to seeing that was like, I don't know, I'll wait and see if that's actually, if there's anything at the popular level that's going to matriculate out of that. There's a couple of questions I like to end with. And one of them, is there anything from the book that you wanted me to ask about that I haven't? And I know there's so much in there. If you want to, you could just run through exhaustively everything I left out. But anything you were hoping we would talk about today that I neglected to ask about?
Yeah, I did spend a great deal of time and over decades, actually, trying to come to an explanation for why the Bible could have been seen to be such a strong support for the American slave system. And I think that's an obvious reaction of someone who gets into the literature, that what was written in the antebellum period, because in our day, I suppose it's not impossible to find, but you just wouldn't find too many people saying the American slave system was a real good thing, because it's what the Bible taught the way society should be organized. Okay, so we have that difference between what's a very widespread just assumption today. Of course, the Bible's against slavery. How can anybody ever hold that notion? But then when you go back into the history, you realize that all sorts of people, good people, Bible believing, people who thought slavery was really bad, but couldn't bring themselves to condemn it because they felt that in some ways the Bible defended slavery. So that was actually one of the things that struck me in a minor way back in 1978 and 79, when I was working on this first paper on the question, and then got stronger and stronger over the years. There's been some wonderful books published on this question. And then the deeper I got into the more it became a real good question, because certainly a majority of Northern voices, people who wrote on this issue from about 1820 to 1860, concluded either the Bible without ambiguity affirmed slavery, or the Bible in some way at least was going to allow it. And that's in the North. In the South, as you can imagine, the white population was almost unanimous in believing that the Bible approved of slavery. And getting into the arguments, and over the decades, I probably read about 100 or more extensive pro-slavery Bible arguments and about the same number of anti-slavery Bible arguments. The interpretive cruxes, the interpretive disagreements came over passages like found in Leviticus 25, where Moses is recorded as saying that Israel may take captive of the nations around them and may pass on those captives as slaves to their children. There are, of course, passages in Genesis also about Abraham having slaves. How can you say you're against slavery if the one who in the Old Testament was pointed out to be the father of all believing people? And then actually in the 1830s and 1840s on to the 1850s, the pro-slavery Bible defense became more focused on the New Testament. Jesus says a lot of things to modify Old Testament law, but never says a word about slavery. And then here's the Apostle Paul says, slaves, obey your masters in the Lord. And so you had, in the use of the scriptures, a really strong pro-slavery Bible position that included the argument that if somehow you say you believe the Bible, but you contend that the Bible does not approve of slavery, you must be lying. You must be, and the word was used all the time, you must be an infidel. There was actually a strong anti-slavery Bible argument, but it was always involving more than one step or always more than one consideration. There were African Americans and then a few whites who, in arguing that the Bible condemns slavery, say, look, who in the scriptures are the slaves? They're all white people. They're all Caucasians or Asians. They're not Africans. So if you think the Bible approves of slavery, then that must mean an African-American in the United States has just as much right to enslave a white child as a white owner has to enslave a child of an African-American. That was one argument. And there were other arguments who said, now, look, let's remember that the Bible was written for its own times and places. If the Apostle Paul had condemned slavery in his day, he would have been seen as a rebel in the Roman Empire, and he would have been attacked mercilessly and eliminated right away. And then think about what was possible for the early church. For the early church, they had to get along in Rome and wasn't going to shake the system. But what was involved? Take a look at the book of Philemon. And of course, pro and anti people love to take a look at the book of Philemon. The people who thought the Bible defended slavery say, look, the Apostle Paul sent back a slave to his owner. And the anti-slavery people said, yes, he did. But he also said to Philemon, treat this escaped slave Onesimus like a brother. And who ever enslaved their brother? So the arguments went back and forth. And then there were African-American authors, speakers, and a few whites who said, look at the whole story. Abraham did have slaves, but he also, we read in Genesis, circumcised his slaves. And what did that mean? They were counted as adopted children of Israel. And what do we know about the children of Israel? Every 7 years, those who were in bondage to other Israelites needed to be liberated. The year of Jubilee meant liberation. And that would mean, in Christian terms, and since the whole world now is potentially children of Abraham, spiritual children of Abraham, it just is wrong to hold in perpetual bondage those who, by the model of the Old Testament, should be liberated every 7 years and have their positions restored. So it was a combination by the anti-slavery people of analysis of the current situation. Why is slavery only of Africans? And then of the biblical situation. What's the historical context? So that trying to track those arguments down and actually seeing how they survived in many quarters past the Civil War was a major part of the research of the book, and something I'm still wrestling with is how to make the best of. It was also fun to look at how people who read the Bible not in English participated in American history. By the 1920s, there had been 100 different publishers of German language Bibles in the United States. Bible translation begins in the 1660s and 70s with John Eliot to the Algonquin Indians, and is a major strand throughout the story way up to the present. There are some really interesting women interpreters of the Bible who had to struggle to get public room for their voice, and just all sorts of interesting issues. And I guess historians are people who, once they start scratching at a problem, can make it a huge wound and just keep at it and keep at it and keep at it.
Keep scratching. Which are you going to? Do you have an intention of doing a third volume that brings us into the 21st century?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is part of the argument of the book is that because of this debate over slavery and the inability of Bible readers to convince one another of the teaching of Scripture, after the Civil War, you have a gradual movement of the Bible out of the center of American civilization. I end the book in 1911 with the celebrations of the tercentenary of the King James Version of the Bible. And there was all sorts of speeches and publications and books. Most of them, however, were treating the Bible as a kind of resource for American democracy, much more than as a vital spiritual guide. And it seemed clear, and the Bible has clearly remained very important for many Americans of different types, right up to the present, but it's just not a situation anywhere like it was. When, for example, in his second inaugural address in 1865, Abraham Lincoln quoted 4 or 5 times from the King James Version in a very short address, as if he was using those words to tell the truth. And that's really remarkable, because Lincoln was not a church member. He never professed Christian faith in any kind of unambiguous way. And yet here he was using the Bible to enforce what he considered the moral opposition to slavery, and then the moral obligation to extend charity to all. We have had a few occasions like that in the present and close to the present. I think during the civil rights movement, we had some advocacy for the civil rights of African Americans using the Bible effectively. We certainly saw President Obama in the sermon talk he gave at the memorial service for Clemente Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina, after he and several of his members of his church were killed. Obama talked about grace and used scripture to explain what he meant by grace. We have a few occasions like that, but the situation is just very different now than it was right into the 1860s, 70s, and 80s.
Okay, that's our loss. Are there books or websites or blogs, whatever, that you would point people to say, hey, learn more about history from these places, other than your books?
Yes, there are, but I'm not sure I could give you a short list right now. The work on the Bible became so interesting and it extended for so many years that I'm going to do the terrible thing and say to people, if you're interested in more of the illuminating studies, then get the book and look at the footnotes, because there's citations of just dozens and dozens of really interesting studies on how the Bible has been put to use historically. Now, you are probably in a better position to recommend books on how, for believers, the Bible should be put to use in the present that are not necessarily primarily historical. My contribution, and also my limitation, has been to work mostly on historical studies. I'll mention just a couple. There's a wonderful newer book by a man named Christopher Tomlinson called, it has to do with Nat Turner, the Virginia slave who led a rebellion in 1831. I think it's in the matter of Nat Turner or something. Tomlinson's argument is,
I'll look it up,
that Nat Turner was in today's terms, a kind of charismatic Bible believer influenced by certain of the revivalistic themes that Tomlinson could trace back to Jonathan Edwards before Turner felt called as a kind of prophet to take up arms against slave owners. And that's a really important argument, because while people have worked on Nat Turner have known he was a religious person and had a knowledge of the scriptures, they've tended to treat his opposition to slavery as primary, and then his understanding of religion is a kind of a garnish on his opposition. But Tomlinson said, maybe not. Maybe the deep immersion in the Bible and the conviction, Tomlinson actually points out the number of places where Nat Turner seems to have been riffing on the Gospel of Luke. And this is really a very interesting study. Pardon me, just because I didn't know about African-American history all that well. The books that have stuck out to me oftentimes are dealing with Black Christian believers. Alan Callahan has a really interesting volume called The Talking Book, which explains how Black believers heard about, learned about, appropriated, and then put the Bible to use. I'm afraid that once I got start going on books that helped me out, we'd have to extend this broadcast way, way too long.
I would gladly do that, but I know you have to get out of here in a moment. So last question then, what do you read for fun?
I'm a historian, so I read histories. Just finished a really long book on a history of the German military from the 16th century to the 21st century. I also read a lot of mysteries. I've been enjoying trying to catch up on books that have been around a long time recently by Tony Hillerman, whose detectives are Navajo police, and there's stories, a lot of really good background on the Hopis and the Navajos and the other Native American groups that now live in New Mexico and Arizona and southern Utah. I try to stay up on current events also by reading a few magazines and newspapers.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here. This was a pleasure. Like I said, I'm withholding my gushing over what a fan I am of yours for the intro that I record separate from this.
Thank you. It's been really a privilege, and it won't shock you to say that it's always nice to talk about a book where the interviewer has read the book and has intelligent questions.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe and rate the podcast on your favorite platform. If you are interested in following, supporting, or engaging with the podcast anywhere else, check out the link tree that I've hyperlinked in the show notes. I try to put episodes out as soon as possible for $5 a month on Patreon. So if there's something that I've announced or you've seen on social media, just know $5 a month, you can listen to every episode that I have edited. Take care.